Good morning. It's good to see our events today. My name is Kenny. We have about four. I'm the lead pastor here at Revolution. And here's what we're up to this morning. This Sunday, we are continuing in our interlude series for this year, which is on the Beatitudes. If you're new to Revolution, the interlude series is a thing that I got very excited about. I still get very excited about, but it's very nerdy and weird, and so sometimes it requires explanation. An interlude series is a series that we come back to over and over again throughout a year, kind of like one sermon at a time, and so we scatter the things out so that it kind of becomes a theme that we are covering and touching on as the year goes on. And in the past, we've used these series, these interlude series, to explore things like the Psalms or the parables of Jesus. And this year, what we're doing is we're taking a closer look at the nine blessings of Jesus that are found in the Gospel of Matthew. So to put things in some quick context this morning, the Beatitudes come at the beginning of a passage in Matthew known as the Sermon on the Mount. You might have heard of that passage before. And there's some debate about whether or not this sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, is a single spoken message that people have recorded, or if it's a collection of kind of the most common themes in all of Jesus' messages. But either way, however you understand that part of the Gospel of Matthew, we should consider, I think, these opening verses as a kind of thesis statement, revealing again my past as an English teacher, thesis statement, about key concepts in Jesus' ministry. And that these concepts are framed as blessings feels important. And I also think it's worth remembering what we learned about that word the last time we talked about these verses. So, as a quick refresher, the Aramaic word that's translated here as blessed is actually ashrei. And it doesn't mean something God gives, which is how we often think of blessings, as things God gives to us. In fact, what it means is the good life belongs to you. The good life belongs to you. We learned before that this distinction between a thing God gives you and an identification of what the good life is matters because it helps to transform these verses from a list of things that we need to do in order to receive God's favor, which is how sometimes we read them, into a list of places that we can be in our lives and still discover that God has drawn near to us there. In the first beatitude, God's kingdom is near to those who are poor in spirit or who are lacking in confidence that they have power or agency in the world. And this matters because in earthly terms, people like this, people who feel powerless, are far away from the comfort and the relief of their kings or of their leaders. To be powerless is to be on kind of the opposite end of the spectrum from your king. But it matters that in God's kingdom, people who are far away from power are actually right where they need to be, because God has drawn near to them through Christ so that they might find hope. In this week's Beatitude, we're looking at another surprising place where God is eager to find us. And it's when we've experienced loss. To get the passage in front of us, we can look at Matthew 5:4, which reads as follows: "The good life belongs to those who mourn, for they will be comforted." There's a lot of stuff to say here. And if your first reaction to that verse is that it seems almost perverse to say that those who mourn have found ashrei, I want to say that I think that's exactly right. This past week, I reread one of my very favorite books of all time. I'll put it in my top 10. One of my top 10 favorite books of all time, Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. There's no cheering. You guys need to read more, frankly. Slaughterhouse-Five is a notoriously difficult book to summarize, but what matters is that it is first a book about the Allies' firebombing of the German city of Dresden in the closing days of World War II, which was an event that the author was present at as a prisoner of war, an event that he survived because he was locked in the titular slaughterhouse number 5. So now you know what the title refers to. But second, it is also the story of a made-up person named Billy Pilgrim who has come unstuck in time. Now, Billy's story takes up most of the book, and the big idea is that Billy was abducted on his wedding night by aliens who have the capacity to see in four dimensions. None of you have your phones out to order this book. There you go, that's fine. All right. Now, the four-dimensional thing. So this means that for them, for these aliens, time is an observable thing, much like width, height, and depth are for us. And so they abduct Billy, in part, because they want him to learn to understand time in the same way that they do. And once he does understand time like they do, he becomes fixated on trying to share his perspective, or the alien's perspective, with everybody else. And the reason that this is important to him is because how the aliens see time has transformed how he thinks about grief. To quote Billy briefly, "The most important thing I learned was that when a person dies, he only appears to die. He is still very much alive in the past, so it is very silly for people to cry at his funeral. All moments, past, present, and future, always have existed, always will exist. The aliens can look at all the different moments just the way we can look at a stretch of the Rocky Mountains. When they see a corpse, all they think is that the dead person is in bad condition in that particular moment, but that the same person is just fine in plenty of other moments. Now, when I myself hear that somebody is dead, I simply shrug and say what they say about dead people, which is so it goes." I'll be super clear with you. Kurt Vonnegut is not scripture. But what I see when I read this passage is a profound act of wrestling with the world. The author has personally experienced genuine horror in his life, radical and barbaric violence. And in order to wrap his head around that experience, he has imagined a way in which the finality of death might not need to seem final at all. And by doing so, I think he sheds a little light on what I think is the ultimate crisis that we face when we experience loss ourselves, is that we are afraid that we are running out of time. What makes mourning so painful are the competing senses that on the one hand, we're feeling a profound pain that needs to take over our lives for a little while. And on the other hand, we're being reminded by that loss that none of us are going to be here forever. So the time that we lose to mourning feels precious. And as much as we want to give that process what it takes, that sadness is at war with this other pressure in us to move on because time is short. And this, I think, is why we tend to describe this experience sometimes as feeling paralyzed, which is a word we use to communicate that we have this pressing need to move on, but that we don't know how to. And yet, Jesus says that people in that spot have the good life. That the good life belongs to those who mourn, for they will be comforted. And so what on earth can you mean by that? I think substituting a word can be helpful for us. So what I want to do, if you'll permit it, is I want to trade the word mourn for the word grief. So what is grief? The root here is connected to a Latin word for weight, which communicates that grief is a burden that settles onto us and that makes itself felt. It's a heaviness on us. It is also, as we understand it, a process by which that weight of a loss is absorbed into our bodies, and then in time, kind of redistributed in our bodies so that even though we still feel the heaviness of that loss, we're able to move again. And I think the word mourn helps us to see that process of going from a crushing heaviness to a heaviness redistributed so we can move. It helps us see the process, but I think the word mourn hides the weight And I think it also hides that we can grieve all sorts of things besides death. And we can grieve the loss of opportunities in our lives. The friends that we lose when we move from one place to another. The fracture of a marriage. The difference between how we imagined our life might go and the way that it is ultimately ending up. I think Billy Pilgrim might be able to see all of that sadness and say, so it goes. But we can't. In fact, words like so it goes tend to make us feel angry because we're not unstuck in time. And time is the reason the grief hurts so damn much. Eventually, we know that that heaviness on our shoulders is going to need to be absorbed. The question is when? And once the weight has lessened, like how much time are we even going to have left? In the notes that our preaching team supplied to help me plan this sermon, I found these words in all capitals. No shortcuts. I think this is the hard truth of grief. Feelings have to come out. We have to let them break up and then get redistributed inside us. And we can't rush this. At least from where I sit or stand, in the case this morning, this is why mourning feels so cruel. Because not only have I lost time with what or with whom I'm grieving, I am still actively losing time. I grew up with a vision of God that was a lot like the aliens in Slaughterhouse-Five. That God was unstuck in time, and thus unable to really know what loss means. How could a being with the perspective of God ever actually empathize with what it means to be a mortal person? How could he ever understand frustration and fear if he knows how everything ends up? And here's Jesus in the beginning of Matthew's gospel telling me that grieving is part of the good life, but what does he even know about it? I'm curious, like, have you ever felt that way? What can God possibly know about this impossible choice that every pitiful one of us has to make when we lose something precious? We have to decide between letting it go and just curling up and dying where we sit. And what comfort could possibly draw near to us when we're in a place like that, facing a choice like that? And also, what kind of a God would force us to make a choice like that in the first place? But here is what I've learned that God knows, and what Jesus and Jesus alone has the ability to reveal to us. That is, that death is not the end. There's a story in the Gospel of John about the death of Jesus' dear friend Lazarus. In the story, Jesus hears of Lazarus' death when he's traveling through the countryside, and it takes him 4 days to get back to Lazarus' village. And when he arrives there at the village in Bethany, a crowd has gathered at the house to sit with Lazarus' sisters, Mary and Martha, in their grief. And this is part of a Jewish tradition that we're going to talk about again in a few minutes, known as sitting Shiva. And John writes this. He writes that when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him while Mary stayed at home. And Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that God will give you whatever you ask of him." And Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." And Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." And Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" I love this exchange. Martha is direct about the guilt trip, isn't she? If you'd been here, this wouldn't have happened. And when Jesus tells her that her brother's story is not yet over, you can could sense Martha like rolling her eyes in response when she says, "I know he's going to rise again on the last day." Martha is in no mood for a sermon from Jesus. But what does Jesus do? What he does is he gently redirects her to her own beliefs. Do you really trust in the compassion of God? Do you really trust in the promises of God? Or do you imagine God is just unstuck in time and can't feel things like you feel them? You already know how the story is going to go, right? Jesus is going to go to the tomb, and he's going to call his friend Lazarus back to life with the word. But what offers comfort, I think, in this story is what happens before Lazarus is raised. So Jesus goes into the house where Mary is grieving, and even knowing what is about to occur, because remember, he knows what's going to happen, he sits with her, and in the shortest verse of the entire Bible, John writes that Jesus wept. Which for me, I think, begs the question, why is it that Jesus chooses not to rush the rising? I think the answer is because grief is love pouring out. That it doesn't need to hurry. And that the reason we tend to hurry it is because we're afraid we don't have time. But Jesus' whole reason for being here is to help us discover that we do. So let yourself hurt, because hurting isn't the end. And let yourself weep, because weeping isn't the end. And let yourself mourn, because mourning isn't the end. And grief is a process that honors love, and that love is going to win. Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead, and then his sisters get more time with him. And just a few short weeks later, and largely a part of his decision to raise Lazarus from the dead, Jesus is going to face death himself. And when that happens, Mary and Martha are going to be there, and they're going to grieve him. They're going to have a chance to grieve again. Their love's going to pour out. But then, they're going to get more time. I think the reason that we don't need to be rush the rising people, the reason we don't need to rush the rising is because we're people uniquely equipped to trust that there is more story yet. It's not that God is unstuck in time. It's not that we have to choose between feeling our feelings or saying cynically, "So it goes." It's that God sees an infinite number of chapters stretching out past the spot that we think is the end. And he has promised us over and over and over again that in those chapters after the end, every single wrong is going to be righted. And every single wound is going to be mended. And every single tear flowing down every single loving cheek is going to be wiped away. That the kingdom of God is drawing near where we are grieving, and the good life belongs to those who mourn, because they will be comforted. And if this is true, then what Jesus delivers us from isn't pain. What he delivers us from is the fear that time is running out and that our losses are final. Isn't this a discovery that lines up more closely to the story that Jesus lives out? Pain is something that he too is going to know. Death is something he too is going to experience. But resurrection is where our hope comes from, because resurrection dissolves the boundary line of which we are most afraid. Resurrection dissolves the boundary line of the thing we're so scared. So if grief is valuable, and if death is not the end, the question is, how then should we live? In his letter to the Christians in Rome, the Apostle Paul aims to rewrite the rules for living as resurrection people. That's how the early church keeps framing it. We are resurrection people. Jesus' victory over death on that first Easter Sunday was this tidal wave sweeping through the hearts and minds of the people who knew him. And after it had washed away all the fear and the old structures and codes which existed to help them manage that fear, this new way of being a Jesus community needed to be established, needed to be articulated. And so the letter to the Roman Christians is full of exactly that kind of wisdom. How do we live as new people when the old fears have been washed away? And that book, that letter to the Romans, culminates in this list of instructions in Romans chapter 12 that goes like this. Paul writes, "Let love be genuine. Abhor what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Do not be slothful in zeal. Be fervent in spirit. Serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope. Be patient in tribulation. Be constant in prayer. Contribute to the needs of the saints and seek to show hospitality." This is how you are a resurrection person. He says, "Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all, if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all." And these instructions are united, I think, by these two Jesus principles, these two new Jesus principles for resurrection people. And the first is this: freedom from fear. Because your story is going to go on for eternity, you do not need to be cautious or stingy with your heart or with your empathy or with your wealth. So live as if there is no tomorrow. Don't compromise your values and be kind to everybody. You've got time. Give things away freely. They don't matter. Look for the people who are in need and rush to help them. The world ends tomorrow. You are free from fear, so live like it. And this is the first Jesus principle. But the second principle is even more resonant, at least for me. And it goes like this: because your story is going to go on for eternity, live as if there are infinite tomorrows. Live as if you have all the time in the world. So be patient in tribulation. It's going to pass. Be constant in prayer. You're in no hurry. And weep with those who are weeping. Let all the love and all the sadness out, and don't rush the rising. Because Jesus grieved, suffered, and rose from the dead, we are more free than anyone in the history of the world to mourn with others and offer them comfort because we are in no hurry. This freedom to sit with people, to be the people who go to sit with those who are hurting and who give them all the space they could ever need to go through what they're going through, this freedom can be expressed in these three specific ways. This is how I'll close today. The first is this: we can face pain with hope. Our faith is rooted in the trust that every wrong is going to eventually be made right, and so every wrong can be felt fully and seen in all of its terribleness without fear. We can go into dark places with other people because we're carrying light with us. So we should be the first ones to show up in hard spots, right? The first to show up at the bedside of the person lost to addiction. The first to the prison cell of the person who has done something incredibly awful and wrong. The first to be there for a parent who has lost a child or a child who's lost a parent. Our hope is needed in those spaces. And it doesn't have to be shared in sermons or in words. It can be shared just through a willingness to be present, no matter how dark the space is. The second thing is that we can indulge our own grief. Because Jesus made time to weep, we can take time to weep. We have all eternity in front of us, which means we can take our feelings slow. We can allow sadness into ourselves and not rush it. We can see mourning as an experience of love and not as some path we need to hurry through so that we can get over it. We can trust that our God sees and understands exactly that journey. We don't need to panic or worry about time because we believe there's more. The third and last thing is this, we can sit with each other. The patience that we learn to give ourselves can be given generously to other people. We can be take feelings slow people. Because of Jesus, we are uniquely equipped to wait through grief. And I would contend the world desperately needs people like that in it. So we need to be people who are eagle-eyed when it comes to grief, who are eager to show up on a person's doorstep or make a phone call or give time to the people who need it. We noted earlier that Mary and Martha were sitting Shiva for their brother Lazarus, and that their friends in Bethany came to sit with them. This is an honored practice, sitting Shiva, is an honored practice in the Jewish faith, and I think it's something that we of all people need to strive to recover. What happens is the friends of a bereaved person encircle them, and they meet all of their needs for 1 week. They feed them every meal, they make their bed, they clean the house, they like watch the kids, they feed the animals, like whatever needs to be done, all the community comes together and does every single thing so that the person at the center of grief can just feel what they're feeling and not worry about anything else. There's room, there's time, there's no rush. I think it'd be a beautiful thing for this community of 50 of us to learn to be sitting Shiva people. And even more than that, when Jesus says that the good life belongs to those who mourn, he's saying that the kingdom of God offers hope and comfort anywhere we might be. We don't have to go seeking it. It has already come near to us where we are. If we can be rewired by this truth, then we can be ministers of God's eternal story in a frightened world that needs more people like this in it. So may we see the kingdom more clearly, and may we share this kingdom more freely with others, today, tomorrow, always.